Hey team, just before we jump into today's pod, I want to let you know that we have a free newsletter called the Good Gear Newsletter, where we talk about policy issues, how to build your AOD career with interviews with specialists in the field, and we also talk about how to beat addictive patterns. Each newsletter has a different theme and we write about different stuff, but it's where the real conversation goes down. So we would love if you could subscribe there and have the real conversations with us. Email us back. We have two-way conversations. It's really cool to build the community and hear people's thoughts. We're putting a lot of effort and grind into this year's podcast and social media. So we would love if you would go over to all the different podcast and social media places and like and subscribe. It helps us to hack the algorithms and reach people and help people that might be out there looking for some help and support. All right, enough from me. Let's jump into the pod. Peace. Boom. What's happening, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Real Drug Talk. Now, we got Kira Middleton on the podcast today. I'm just going to call it early. She's nervous as fuck. All right. I can swear she probably doesn't want to. So everybody virtually through the ear pods or the speakers or whatever, give her like positive warm vibes because she's a rock star and she will smash it. And today we actually wanted to talk about the NDIS, and I wanted to hear as someone that I know professionally and is all across this stuff. And I wanted to get her on to talk a little bit about it and how it relates to drug and alcohol stuff, because I know a lot of people that listen to the show are NDIS participants, have packages, or have questions about it, want to get involved in it, or are just generally kind of curious about it. But it kind of can get a little bit technical, I guess, when it comes to drug and alcohol stuff, which we'll talk a little bit about as well. So, hey, just quickly, tell us where you're from. Like, what's your company? What do you do? How do you service? How do you guys fit into the NDIS as a company?
Thanks, Jack. Basically, as mentioned, my name's Kira, and I am the managing director of Just Us & Co. We are a small family-run NDIS provider based on the Gold Coast in Queensland, Australia, and we service in different divisions, I guess, nationally as well. I guess in the NDIS space, it's such a beast, I think, of a thing. So we try
that
and cull it down.
It is a beast.
It's so convoluted. It's so confusing. No matter how long you've been doing it for, you're still learning because things change by the minute in this space. So, we thought let's pick a couple of things that we're really, really good at and leave the rest for others who, are able to do it better than we are. So we specialize in, support coordination, employment support and, core support, which is just, average support work.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So, just quickly, give us like a brief overview, like what is the NDIS? I think it stands for, correct me if I'm wrong, National Disability Insurance Scheme. I think I got that right. What actually is it? And some of those things that you mentioned, I think you said core support, support coordination, like what actually is that? Like what are those functions within the NDIS? Or can you just like unpack that a little bit more for people so they can understand?
Yeah, 100%. So the NDIS was brought in, it really, really kicked off, I think, back in 2018. It was brought in to replace your typical sort of government-funded branch for, to support people with disabilities, the same way we've got funding for public health, housing, you've got Centrelink, things like that. So the NDIS was sort of introduced to offer a more individualized, specific support system for people with disabilities. Disability is so broad. It can range from psychosocial, so mental health, to physical. It's always got comorbidities in there. So you've usually got health issues as well as disability sort of mixed in. And overall, there's a massive impact to people that do, I guess, experience disability. How we experience disability is very different. So they sort of brought it in as a way to individualize support based on a person's needs. Because, again, it's so broad, you might know a few people that have got a diagnosis of ADHD or ASD, so autism spectrum disorder. And whilst there's a lot of traits that are quite similar in those sorts of diagnoses, the way that the disability impacts each person is vastly different. So you might have somebody with the same diagnosis that is able to, you know, maintain a job. They're able to sort of live independently, shower, you know, cook their own meals, things like that. And you might have somebody else on the other end of that who has ASD that cannot, you know, do any of those things and requires a really high level of support. So the NDIS sort of comes in to address and assess each person based on their individual needs. I sort of always explain it to people where, you know, whilst it is there, it's a great thing, I think, in the grand scheme of things. It's fantastic. It's got a lot of potential to do good. It's so convoluted in the way that they do it. So I'm sure it does come from a good place, you know, from the Australian government, but at the very end of the day, it is an insurance scheme. So the first thing I sort of explain to people who are quite new to the NDIS is if you had a car accident tomorrow and you were calling into your insurance and you were sort of trying to claim back, you know, either you'd written off your car or you need repairs done, what's the first thing that you think of when you're approaching insurance? Evidence. Because I can just as easily say it was the guy next to me's fault that my car is written off and I did nothing wrong, and he's probably saying the same thing to his insurer as well. So the number one thing with the NDIS is it is evidence-based, the same way other insurances work. And that's where a lot of people can get caught out, where they don't quite fully understand what we need to be giving the agency to, you know, fund the supports that we're asking for. Where we sort of come into that, I've sort of been in the industry for quite a few years in different areas, just in the general spectrum of, you know, human services. I love working with people. I've done it pretty much my entire career, and I've seen it from a lot of different perspectives. And what I noticed, especially in the NDIS space, is that everything disability related is either has or will be moving under the NDIS. So I kind of had a choice at one point to sort of, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. I loved working with people with disabilities. I saw a lot of heartache in my time working in more specifically the employment space through DES, which is Centrelink, so separate again. But I saw a massive gap in the information that were being provided from the agency on how to apply, who's eligible, what's the process, what am I entitled to, or what can I receive funding for. So a part of our service, it sort of started off with doing a lot of sort of pro bono access requests. So that's where I said, you know what, if I'm going to be a provider, if we're going to work in this space, let's at least try and give back a little bit in that process. So from the very beginning of our time and before then, before we were what we are, I sort of dedicated a lot of my time to helping people who didn't have the finances to go, you know, and see a pediatrician for assessment, or, you know, to pay $2,500 for a functional capacity assessment to, you know, apply. I spent a lot of time with them coaching and helping them gather the information that they needed to, I guess, gain access to the NDIS, and I still try and do that as much as I can in this space.
So that's interesting. So what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the big gaps in the NDIS and for people getting on the insurance scheme is getting that proof, and that proof is some sort of, I don't know if I get the terms right, but the psychological assessments or whatever the assessments are that are needed from specialists to say that a person has this condition or this disability or, you know, this thing that's affecting them And then that's what then allows them to, there's probably other things as well, but that's what allows them to submit to the NDIS agency and try and become a participant. But to get those specialist appointments and pay for them and stuff is the real hard crux part.
Yeah, pretty much.
Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, so I think it's more than just a diagnosis. For a long time, there was sort of like a list of diagnoses that were classified, like, you know, on the NDIS website, where it was like, cool, if you've got evidence that you're diagnosed with A, B, C, or D, you automatically sort of qualify to receive NDIS funding. And then there was a, you know, another page, which was sort of a category B, which was a bit more complex. You need to prove a little bit more about how it impacts you directly. So, there was a part of it that was, yeah, all you needed was an assessment to say, yes, you're diagnosed with this condition, it meets this criteria, we're going to allow you access, you know, to become a participant of the NDIS. But that is changing. That is changing. So they're making it a little bit harder for people to be able to do that. And a good example is, you know, sort of if you have a diagnosis of ASD 2 or above, you're usually pretty confident that you'll be able to gain access to the scheme just based on that assessment alone. But they're sort of taking a turn now where they're looking more at the functional capacity of that person. So, again, how that disability, that diagnosis affects and impacts that particular person's day-to-day living. So instead of saying, well, you've got, you tick the box of the diagnosis, they're saying, well, yeah, you might tick the box here, but we still need more information as to why, you know, or where your functional capacity is impacted.
Right. Yeah, it's so interesting with all this stuff. Like, it's... It's so similar to the alcohol and drug system. Like my biggest thing with the alcohol and drug system is access, and like, forget about, you know, like going to a rehab and whatever. Like for a lot of people, the hardest part is to get the initial assessment and the waiting times for the assessment and to be assessed correctly and put into the thing and go through that whole process. And by the time you fuck around and do all that, while you've got all these like really challenging issues going on personally, it's just like so hard to actually get into the system and access the system. So there's not really a problem with the system. It's more the access to the system. And it sounds like it's kind of, there's a lot of similarities there with like the NDIS as well. And it's only kind of getting harder. And I imagine that's pretty hard for people to do some of these paperwork and some of these forms and stuff while they're trying to deal with their disability as well.
I'm so sorry. I can't hear anything at this point. You completely cut out. And froze in.
That's right. Where did we drop out?
We were talking about the gap of access, and that it's quite difficult for people, you know, with the paperwork and stuff, to even understand like what they're supposed to be doing to gain access.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying. Like, I imagine for the people that you work with, it's to do all of that, like while you're dealing with your disability and the way that that impacts your life, it can just be overwhelming and just incredibly difficult to to try and get yourself some help. Is that what you guys kind of experience day to day? All right, boom. Yep. We disappeared into the Zoom/Riverside Universe, everybody. It happens all the time. Fucking internet. It's meant to make things more accessible, but it seems to cause more problems. We were talking about access and the difficulties that, you know, you guys come across with people trying to access the NDIS and everything that comes along with that. What do you guys actually do to help people bridge that gap and get access to the NDIS and help them through that process?
So pretty much what we do is we try to, I guess, provide some one-on-one individual coaching. So instead of just referring people back to, you know, the written sort of instructions in the access request form, or, you know, referring them back to the NDIS website, what we do is we have a look at each case individually. That might be, you know, one of the first questions that we'll ask is, and in a lot of cases, you know, we're talking about children. So parents will sort of be inquiring about, you know, how do we access the NDIS for our child? So the first question we'll sort of ask is, well, do they have a diagnosis yet? If that person does have a diagnosis, you know, they've seen a pediatrician, or there's, you know, there's signs from the school or something, there's something that's taken place that they've been assessed and confirmed to have a disability, what we'll do is we'll sort of guide them down the path of what to do next. So I've done a lot of corresponding with people's pediatricians or with their GPs, with the schools, if they see any specialists outside of, I guess, the general, you know, health system, we'll liaise with them and we'll sort of coach them through how to complete the access request form. So basically there's two sections. One is for the person. So it sort of goes through, you know, gains consent. It asks a little bit about, you know, their general details, their CRN number for Centrelink, just things like that. And the second section is for their treating professional. Now, the way that it's written, how it seems you're supposed to answer it, they tend to get hung up a lot on wording. So, and we see a lot of applications, or we've seen a lot of applications knocked back based on wording. So what we do is we have lots of conversations with psychologists, psychiatrists, GPs, pediatricians to help guide them on how to correctly write out their section of the application and any corresponding reports. So that sort of, again, you know, the two systems don't really talk. You might have a pediatrician that's done heaps of NDIS applications before and, you know, they've kind of got it down pat how they're supposed to write it, and others have never done it before, or they've done one and they're just writing it the way that they have always written it, right? So we do a lot of coaching and mediating between the participant and their treating professionals to make sure that the wording is as best as we can possibly get it for the purpose of their application. Following that, you know, we give advice. You know, we might ask somebody to write a carer impact statement and coach them through what that could look like. We review all of the reports that they've got as well from their, again, treating professionals to make sure that the key information is in there, such as permanency, treatment history, medication history, what has worked, what hasn't, you know, information about their reduced functional capacity. So we sort of filter through all of that and make sure that it's reading how the NDIS needs it to read. And once we've sort of got all of that information back, what we do is we assist the participant and their families to actually submit it to the NDIS. Once we've submitted the application into the agency and we've had a response that they're successful, they've been accepted onto the scheme, historically what the NDIS would do was call what they call a planning meeting. So they'll meet with the family or the participant and sort of have, like, there's lots of surveys that they need to do. You know, they talk about the needs, they get a background on the person, a bit of like an about me and things like that. And those meetings can take anywhere from sort of 1.5 to 2.5 hours to complete. So when somebody gets that call back from the NDIS, we offer to be present in that meeting to help them, I guess, guide along, explain anything they don't understand, you know, have some extra input into the funding that they might be eligible for, things like that. Now, this particular service, again, is a completely free service, right? They just don't have access to that. They say that the local area coordinators are there to assist with that, but in my experience, there haven't been much help in actually successfully getting people access onto the scheme. And if they have, there's usually a lot of, you know, running around for the participant and their families. And yeah, it's been sort of mediocre in my personal experience working with them. But, you know, we do it because we just see the heartache in the community. We see the people struggling and suffering, and, you know, parents and children and friends and, you know, family members of that person just don't know where to go. So we offer it to, again, just try and give back and close as much of that gap as possible, because the system, how it is just not working. It's just not achieving what it needs to be achieving.
Yeah. So interesting. It's in a lot of ways, I think it's like such a great thing, because it opens up like choice for people to, you know, access services that they might want to access. Whereas like we're in the drug and alcohol system, depending on what catchment you're in, based on where you live or whatever, often that dictates which sort of service you can access, and then somebody tells you based on your criteria what you can access. Whereas the thing that I love about the NDIS is that you, once you're on the scheme, it kind of gives you some choice about what you want to do. But from what you're saying, like, it's just so convoluted and complicated to navigate and and get involved in and access, and it makes it really difficult, and probably a lot of people miss out and fall through the cracks and don't get the help and support that they need. Now, the question that is springing to my mind that I want to ask you is, can people with alcohol and drug issues get on an NDIS package and be part of the NDIS?
Not directly. Drug and alcohol, substance abuse issues can be like a comorbidity, perhaps, to like reflect their functional capacity for everyday living. But I don't believe that addiction can qualify on its own. The other interesting thing in the space is that, you know, you might be able to qualify if you have a drug-related disability, if that makes sense. So for instance, you've got brain damage maybe an overdose that had happened, or you had a stroke or something like that, you know, that resulted in a permanent disability, then yes, you know, there is a chance that you will qualify for an NDIS package. But on the premise alone that it's somebody that is suffering with drug or alcohol addiction, they won't fund it. They basically say, well, you're not our problem, you don't, you know, tick our boxes, so until you've got a permanent disability, go somewhere else. And that is the biggest issue that we see in the industry, is just that handballing of responsibility to other departments that are already seriously underfunded or at capacity. You know, a good example is our healthcare system, right? I don't know how often you sit in emergency for 12 to 15 hours looking, you know, waiting to be seen, or you know, your children, or you know someone that does. But you know, everything is at the brink at the moment in terms of receiving support, and drug and alcohol is something, again, that's way over capacity. There is not enough beds, it is not accessible enough, and again, the departments just sort of shift that blame, shift that responsibility elsewhere until somebody falls through the cracks.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you can't directly get NDIS funding, but if you have co-occurring substance issues along with something else, that does fall under the NDIS scheme. I don't know what the common one is. There any common ones that you see that people have co-occurring kind of issues with?
Yeah, so something that we see commonly with NDIS participants, or people that receive NDIS funding, is mental health, so psychosocial disability. So, you might have people with schizophrenia.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you get an NDIS package? I hope I'm using the right terminology here. Sorry, everyone, if I'm not. I'm just a fucking guy on a podcast. can you get an NDIS package with if you have a mental health condition? Does that fall under the criteria?
So that sort of mental health sort of puts us back into, you know, how earlier in the conversation we were talking about your sort of category A disabilities and your category B. Mental health or psychosocial disabilities are very much category B. And the reason for that, I can understand why they make it a bit harder, because, again, there's such a wide, like, spectrum that, you know, mental health falls under, you know, anxiety, for instance, or depression. You know, at some point, most people, you know, if you haven't yourself, you know, someone you know, experiences anxiety or depression at some point in their life. And, you know, some people are able to treat it or still, you know, live a relatively normal life, and others cannot, right? So technically, yes, you can qualify for NDIS if you've got a mental health condition, but the evidence that you need to be able to qualify is sort of next level. I have done a fair few applications for participants with mental health, and it is a mountain sort of process, and it is very, very complex. And you know what, it's ironic because you're talking about, you know, somebody that is so debilitated by their mental health that they, you know, would like to apply for NDIS funding, and then the agency kind of makes it that much worse for them to actually access that support. So it's almost like a vicious cycle where the NDIS almost contributes to further, you know, poor mental health because of how hard they make it to gain access on a mental health basis. So it is it's a very complex area when we're talking about mental health. It has been done. I believe it still continues to be done. There were some recommendations that came out recently around, you know, there's talks around maybe no longer accepting psychosocial disabilities under the NDIS, and that, you know, they might be thinking about setting up a different sort of funding division more specifically to mental health, but we haven't had any like firm confirmation that that's going to be implemented, so it's sort of still a watch this space moving forward.
Yeah, 100%. So sorry, going back to it's just really interesting, and the more that we talk, like I've just got all these questions that I want to ask you as you're talking. I'm conscious not to interrupt, but it just highlights how complicated it is to navigate, and why your services and you know, people like you are so important to help people to navigate the system. So what I asked you before is, what are some of the common co-occurring issues that you see with substance use with people? You said one was mental health. Is there any others that are, you know, common that you see?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've worked with people who, so mental health is probably the number one. We see a lot of substance, use. I won't use the word abuse because sometimes, it's at that person, you know, however that person feels about their substance use, but so we'll use the word use in this situation. But, mental health, we've got ASD and ADHD is a big one in adults more specifically. I tend to work with a lot more people with, more specifically ADHD as a secondary disability under the NDIS, where we do see a bit of that substance use coming out. And also in some cases, we do see it in intellectual disabilities as well. I think across the board, substance abuse or use or misuse or however you want to put it, it is quite common in this space because a lot of people with disabilities are suffering. A lot of the time they're living below the poverty line. They have either burnt through or don't have access to any informal support, like, you know, friends or family or, you know, anything outside of their NDIS services. And because it's such a beast to navigate, there's a lot of things that the NDIS won't fund that, you know, is technically still related to their disability. A good example of that is, you know, somebody might have a spinal injury or a back injury, you know, and they live in constant pain. Their mobility is impacted severely. They can't do the same things that they did their entire life. You know, they can fall into a depression. They can become very anxious. You know, if you're stuck on your back most of the day or in a chair or not able to drive or not able to work, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're receiving a Centrelink payment, which is, we all know, is not, you know, entirely livable. So mental health then starts to play a part there. And when the NDIS, when you start, you know, talking to the NDIS to request funding for some of these things, such as, you know, psychology or, you know, an increase in your social supports or, you know, there's an abundance of different things, assistive technology even, you know, to try and help their disability or, you know, to help them live as independently as possible. When they start getting rejected, what's the number, like what do people do? They self-medicate because they're asking for help. They're not receiving the help that they need because it, you know, it's not directly connected, or that review officer that day was having a bad morning and decided, no, I'm not going to approve the use of psychology, or we're going to make you wait 6 months before we let you know if you can, you know, access that service or if we're going to fund that service. So a lot of people are stuck in a world of living below the poverty line, no access to friends or family anymore, you know, or, you know, if ever, you know, they don't have, you know, the means to access the services that they need, they're in pain. So what they do is they can self-medicate, just like you or I, if we were living, you know, in that situation. Yeah. So it is very common in the industry. And it's not, it's something that's really not addressed, across the board. Typically seen as, you know, something that, you know, it's just almost like a given. You know, you might get someone handover, or you might have somebody call and inquire and send a referral to you for, you know, somebody that requires, you know, X amount of support work per week. And you know, and a part of the notes will say, oh, yeah, they, you know, they smoke bongs, or they drink quite heavily in the evening, so morning support is better. And it's almost just like no one really blinks at it. No one says, why? Like, what's going on for that person? You know, is there something, is there interventions that we can put in place? Is there drug and alcohol resources that we can provide them? It's almost like, no, we've just got to, you know, follow OH&S, make sure staff are safe, do the morning support when they're not drunk so that, you know, you're safe, instead of, you know, really trying to address the issue. Because the NDIS just, I mean, they don't really, you know, focus on drug and alcohol treatment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting. And I can see how fundamentally, like, you know, that drug and alcohol issues would be so common, as you said, in you know, the population of people that have NDIS packages, because, yeah, they're self-medicating, they're not in good situations, they're stuck in systems that have, you know, kind of kept them held down for a long time. And it's something that I've seen a lot. So, mm-hmm. like, to be honest, for everybody working that listening out there, like, when we ran our outpatient service, you know, we would work with some people with NDIS packages sometimes, because really, I call it exclusion criteria rather than the assessment criteria. They would go to their alcohol and drug provider, and they would be told that they couldn't access the service because of, you know, their disability, and then they would be told that you know, that they couldn't receive drug and alcohol support because it's outside the NDIS funding capacity and things like that. And then you'd have to really go in and advocate and explain that, you know, this is almost like a bridging support to help someone you know, actually work on, get to a space where they can then work on, you know, the other issues that are going on in their life. Is it something that you think a lot of agencies out there have good understanding about, because it is so common in the space, or do you think it's something that's really misunderstood?
I think that there is a lot of misunderstanding. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are people in our community, NDIS recipients or not, right, that choose to use drug and alcohol because they choose to use it. And who are we, right? Like, I mean, we all, you know, there's so much stigma attached, first of all. But, like, if someone makes that decision in their day-to-day, I mean, someone makes that decision. People make decisions every single day, and we don't have to agree, you know, with all of them. But, you know, I think that there's not enough education and training in among us NDIS providers, more specifically, because it's not something that the NDIS really acknowledges, right? So we're all trained, or, you know, you'll have people that offer, you know, support services, for instance, that might have minimal training on drug and alcohol. They might have risk management training to, you know, the person, like, in, you know, their behavior support plans or something on how to react when somebody is, you know, displaying, you know, behaviors of concern. You might, you know, call 000. Like, it's all pretty basic on how to respond. And because it's so, like, ignored, I suppose, in the space. Providers just kind of, like, we all almost have to just, like, accept that it's there. It's their decision. If they're going to use, if they're going to drink, you know, we need to keep ourselves safe, try our best to keep them safe. But at the end of the day, it's not our problem, or it's not our, you know, our place to say. And you know what? Like, in some ways, okay, cool. Like, I think that's good. You give people, you know, the right to choose how they decide to live their life. But on the other hand, we're almost just turning a blind eye to a really big issue. It's a safety issue for support staff that are going in, or therapists, or whoever it is that might be accessing the home. But it's also unsafe for the participant. There's almost like no discussion around it. There's not enough training or awareness around drug and alcohol services that are available to them. Maybe at, you know, at this point in the game, you know, outside of NDIS, there's just not enough discussion happening. And I think that, you know, in this industry, you do, people die. Just like in, you know, a lot of other, you know, people facing industries, you know, they do, they die. And, you know, we had a case really recently where we were engaged to support a gentleman who was known to use substances. And the message that I got was, you know what, like, he's not interested in talking about getting clean or stopping using, you know, like, he just needs somebody there. He loves poetry and, you know, all these other really great things about this person. And before we were even able to commence support, we got the call that he had passed away, that he had overdosed. And, yeah. Like that's hard to be in our position as providers, and there's just not much you can do, or there's no one listening. And then there's a whole line of people who got to know these people or this person that, you know, really put everything they had into it to at least just make their life semi-comfortable, just so they had some support, someone to talk to, some way back to the roots of what they enjoyed doing. And before you're even able to, you know, get in there and start doing that work with them, you know, these sorts of things happen. And there are services around that do, you know, your outreach and stuff. But again, there's so much red tape. There's, again, like, the exclusion criteria. Like, as soon as you don't tick that box, we can't help you, someone else's problem. And it's really sad. It's really tough for a lot of people out there. And there's just not enough light on the issue in the NDIS space specifically at the moment.
Yeah, 100%. So, a couple of practical questions. People listening to this that maybe are on the NDIS scheme or looking to get on it, or know somebody or have a family member, whatever it is, there is drug and alcohol issues going on there as well. Like, what should they do? What's the best way to kind of help address some of this stuff? Or is it a case of there's not many people kind of out there that are engaging with the, you know, support with drug and alcohol through the NDIS scheme?
Yeah. I think look, it's tricky. On one hand, you know, you could almost hit the sweet spot where if you do, you know, if you are accessing the scheme already, and you've got, you know, a disability, whatever that may be, as well as substance abuse issues, the number one thing to do would be, you know, do your research on the providers that you're using to provide, you know, support. Sometimes you can hit the nail on the head and you can find a provider that has staff who are either have drug and alcohol experience or specialize in being able to work in drug and alcohol. Some people might have, you know, they might have qualifications in the field, but, you know, they're doing a different sort of line of work. So sometimes you can get lucky and find somebody that's offering a service such as, you know, support work or employment support or whatever it might be, you know, with that experience. So my biggest bit of advice is vet the people that are coming out to support you. Ask the questions. They might have really great reviews, or your friend might use them and have had a really good experience, or you might have seen them everywhere all over Facebook, and you know, they might be quite reputable. But you know, the people that are supporting you need to have the right experience for you. So they might be great for one, but not
for another. And that goes for us as well as a provider. We're not, we're all human beings. We've got our special, you know, skills, and we're really good with certain things, but not in others. But that's, you know, that's why there's an abundance of providers out there, because we all have our own sort of niches. We've all got things that we're really good at, and we've got things that we don't know enough about. So, ask the questions to the providers that you're looking to engage, and just, you know, spend some time looking for someone that does have that specialized knowledge in drug and alcohol, more specifically to this conversation. The next sort of part of it would be connecting with your community supports. At the moment, the hardest thing, and it has been for many years, and I'm sure you've seen this a lot as well, Jack, is that accessing things like rehab or detox, it's all voluntary. And I think someone told me once, I think there was like 12 beds available for involuntary treatment in New South Wales or something. In the whole of New South Wales, there's like 12 spots, and it's like almost impossible to have somebody put on an involuntary, you know, sort of treatment order. So, you know, the hardest thing in this situation is that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. There is nothing that says, hey, this is available, you know, you have to go. Everything is all around, again, choice and control. It's about, you know, encouraging, coaching, you know, providing, you know, information about what's available to them. But at the end of the day, it's a tricky spot, because unless that person wants to receive treatment, they don't have to. So, you know, for families out there, I suppose, that have got a loved one that is accessing the NDIS or is trying to access the NDIS, do your research, ask the questions, find people that are experienced in drug and alcohol, in treatment, that have maybe worked in rehabs before or in hospitals, you know, treating drug and alcohol in hospitals, and go with a provider that is able to sort of do some of that work in the background under your funding through regular support. There's a very fine line in the NDIS. It's very easy to commit fraud. It is everywhere at the moment. So, you know, people will, you know, post out there, we run, you know, this sort of service for NDIS participants, whether it's, I don't know, driving lessons or something that's not, you know, actually funded under the NDIS. And, you know, they'll say, oh, we can bill it under a different line item. You know, we can bill it as, you know, skills development and training or whatever it is. But, you know, it can be very quickly and very easily seen as fraud, and that's it. You're out of business and you owe a lot of money to the government. So you've got to fit this really weird, you've got to tick this really weird box to make sure that, number one, you're not committing fraud. Number two, you're working within the NDIS guidelines. Number three, actually making a difference to what that person needs, because there's so many people out there that offer services and they vary so much. And, you know, there's not enough regulation around it as well, in terms of that. So, the biggest thing is just do your research, ask the questions. Don't be afraid to wait a little bit longer to find that right fit for you. Because if you do, you know, end up with the wrong fit sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, it can make things worse. And you can end up getting in trouble as well, with the NDIS and, the fraud department. So, I don't know if that really even answered your question, Jack, if I'm honest, but,
no, 100%.
It's just, 100%. It's tricky.
As you can tell, everyone, this is why I wanted to have Kira on, because, it can seem like a bit of a stale topic, but it's something that so many people are interested in, because so many people out there need help and so many people are looking to access something to get them help. And you're an absolute gun and wizard. So if people do need help, give us the plug. What's your business name again, and how can people get in contact with you guys and get that quality support and help?
Again, we are Just Us and Co. We've got social media active. We're on LinkedIn, Instagram and Facebook, so feel free to give us a like or a follow, and stay up to date with, I guess, the different things that we're doing in the community. I've got my contact details on there directly. So if anyone needs to just chat through their particular situation or they're looking to receive services for an existing NDIS plan, feel free to hit me up.
Awesome, mate. Awesome. And that'll all be in the show notes, people. Hey, thanks so much for coming on and explaining it all, and have a lovely day, everybody. Peace.
Thanks.